I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Israeli and world music legend David Broza. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Mavina on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. To be honest with you, my fair listeners of 2 Jewish, I can't always pretend to be a totally sane person. About 2 weeks ago, I proved it and biked the 102 miles of the Tour de Tucson. Riding over 100 miles on a bicycle in one day in the course of a morning and early afternoon is not the act of a normal person. This marks the fourth year in a row I have done this. Mind you, a couple of thousand other less than sane people do this ride too, and while it's not exactly easy, it's great fun. People who ride the tour are almost universally friendly, and chatting with those who ride about the same pace as I do, getting to know a few of them over the hours of cycling, is one of the great perks of this experience. The tour raises substantial funds for local and national charities, and many people were also generous enough to sponsor my ride as a donation to our own congregation Beit Simcha, dynamic young synagogue in the northwest and foothills of Tucson. Thank you to those of you who did. Anyway, the tour begins and ends in downtown Tucson, and there was a wonderful moment right after I finished the ride. Everyone who completes the tour receives a medal as though we had won the Olympics, the Tour de France or something. They are awarded based on how long it takes you to finish. Professional riders race the whole distance in under 5 hours. They get a platinum medal. If you complete the 102 miles in more than 5 hours but less than 6, you get a gold medal, and if you finish in more than 6 hours but less than 9 hours, you get a silver medal, and finally, if you finish between 9 and 10 hours, you receive bronze. For 4 straight years, I have ridden the 100 miles in a little over 6 hours, and no matter how much I train or how hard I try, I never get any faster, so I always get a silver medal. This year, after I finished, I went to the silver medal table, showed them my time, and yet again received a silver medal. But as I walked by the gold medal table, a volunteer worker called out, "Do you want your gold medal?" And I said, "I want one, but I didn't earn it." And the worker instantly said, "Oh, you must be a millennial," which was pretty darned funny. You know, I hadn't earned it, but I felt entitled to it, just like all those irritating millennials. Funny, but also unfair. Of course, the reputation of millennials among the baby boom generation is of a large group of younger people who have a spectacular sense of entitlement and don't believe in working hard. You know, they were born in this world and therefore believe they'll automatically get into a good college, be given straight A's no matter how bad they are as students, get handed a good job, and get promoted. Whether or not they can do anything more productive than post on Instagram or Snapchat, play video games, watch TikTok videos, or create their own self-absorbed YouTube channel. Millennials have zero ability to concentrate more than a few minutes at a time because they have to check their fancy phones incessantly. And when millennials are taken to task for living narcissistic, lazy lives, they just post or text, "Okay, boomer," as a universal put-down, rather than actually doing something useful with their lives. I myself have groaned about the absent work ethic of this younger cohort, who seems so filled with a desire to take over the world, provided they can do it without ever breaking a sweat, or working in an environment that doesn't provide free kombucha and ping-pong tables. Of course, some of you may recall that the baby boom generation, of which my contemporaries and I represent the tail end, was not exactly beloved of our parents' and grandparents' generations when we caromed into early adulthood and destroyed all societal standards of dress and behavior with long hair, blue jeans, rock music, and, gasp, marijuana use. I suspect our parents' generation scandalized their own parents with swing music, jitterbug dancing, and Americanized slang. And probably their parents horrified their grandparents by doing radical things like immigrating to America and speaking English instead of Yiddish. I began to wonder if this deep bias against a useless younger generation had ever existed in previous eras. So I opened the Babylonian Talmud, the great source of Jewish law and lore, and there I found in Brachot 35b, Tseire'e shelo dorot harishonim kedorot ha'achronim. Come and see, the latter generations are not like the former generations. Rather, these new generations are inferior. That phrase is repeated multiple times in the Talmud, and in every case it has to do with the skewed priorities and inferior dedication of the new generations when compared to their much superior elders. The old-timers were great, and the youngsters are second-rate in knowledge, dedication, and plain old-fashioned grit. Mind you, the Talmud was completed 1,500 years ago. So a millennium and a half ago, older people were kvetching about the inferiority of younger people. No doubt those old rabbis were scandalized by the lackluster scholarship of youngsters who refused to memorize the entirety of Jewish law, insisting instead on using newfangled technology, writing it all down on high-tech parchment with fancy, expensive quill pens. The more things change, the more they stay the same. My fellow aging friends, I strongly suspect that this world won't fall apart when millennials and Gen Xers and Gen Zers take over, as they, in fact, already are beginning to do. And the sense of entitlement they manifest is quite likely no worse than the arrogance of youth in every up-and-coming generation, going all the way back to the Talmud, and much earlier than that. For the Bible presents similar examples of snot-nosed youngsters like Jacob or Joseph arrogantly ticking off their elders. Yet those guys ended up doing okay. Don't worry so much about the deterioration of society, of those smarmy brats with their weird hair, odd habits, awful music, entitlement complexes, and complete lack of initiative or follow-through. In truth, they'll turn out to be no worse than we've been, and possibly better, just like every generation before them has. As the Talmud says, Shelo dorot harishonim kedorot ha'achronim, the latter generations are not like the former ones. Well, that's how it's supposed to be, with God's help. Well, they may need a lot of it, but with God's help, these millennial jokers will turn out to be just fine. They'll learn how to work hard and take initiative, and they might even fix the parts of our world that our generation has so fouled up. On that theme, and to play us in this morning, here's a song from our guest, the outstanding Israeli-Spanish-English-American musician and ambassador for peace and coexistence, David Broza. It's his first hit, recorded way back in 1977, a setting of Yonatan Geffen's poem Yieh Tov. It will be good. The words include, we will learn to live together between the groves of olive trees. Children will live without fear, without borders, without bomb shelters. 100 years of war, but we have not lost hope. It will be good. מי יודע אם ישוב הליצן היה למלך הנביא נהיה ליצן ושכחתי את הדרך אבל אני עוד כאן ויהיה טוב יהיה טוב כן לפעמים אני
Azalaila. עפים אל הצבא, ואחרי שנתיים הם חוזרים ללא תשובה. אנשים חיים במתח, מחפשים סיבה לנשום, ובין שנאה לרצח מדברים על השלום.
It's all right, it's okay. Sometimes I just break down. Tonight I know, tonight our love will turn us back around.
That was our guest this morning, David Broza, singing his classic song, Yiye Tov. He'll be with us in a few moments to discuss his incredible career as a guitarist, singer, and ambassador for peace. When we return in a moment, here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. A past guest of Too Jewish, Israeli superstar David Broza, one of the world's really greatest guitarists and most dynamic and vibrant world music performers. He's an incredible player, but also a wonderful singer and composer, and has used music as a means of communicating messages of peace and community throughout the world. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Nice to hear your voice.
Nice to hear your voice.
Thank you.
You're touring again. Do you ever stop touring?
No, I don't. I haven't stopped in 40 years. It's a never-ending tour. Because I have so many possibilities. I can tour by myself, I can tour with a trio, I can tour with a quartet, or more players, or orchestras, and it all depends where I am and what the setting is. So it's a constant move.
You work not only with Spanish musicians, Israeli musicians, but you've also done incredible work working with Palestinian musicians. What's your latest interest?
That's a very good question, and I have a good answer now, because had you asked me that a year ago, I wouldn't have been able to tell you. So I'm finishing up now recording my first instrumental album. You call me a guitarist, but I've never regarded myself as a guitarist. Throughout my career, I've always accompanied myself on guitar, and I know I do a good job of it, accompanying myself. But I never thought of myself as a guitarist.
Huh.
This time, for the first time, I've composed and written instrumental music for the guitar, and went out to Madrid, to Spain, to record it with one of the greatest producers of this kind of music. And we're wrapping up now the whole project, so it'll be ready for next year, for 2020.
Fantastic. You know, it's funny you should say that, because I remember hearing you do a sound check once before a concert. I snuck in. Well, I was snuck in is probably the right term. And you were just fooling around, and it was some of the best musicianship I've ever heard on the guitar. So to call yourself not a guitarist, I wish I was not a cantor like you're not a guitarist.
It's funny, because while making this album, I decided to film it, as I've been filming a lot of stuff in the last few years. And one of the first things that came to mind when asked about this, I said exactly that people have always asked me to record those pieces that I play for myself at soundcheck or between songs. And I call those doodles. I don't call them pieces. They're just my thoughts. And but in this particular album, I actually had to sit down and write instrumental pieces that would
that would gravitate, you know, capture the listener's ear. So whereas I sing a song, I have a story to tell, you know, the voice can say so many things and the guitar accompanying, but here it's just the guitar. So it took me a while to write the stuff, but the recording came out beautiful, and I can't wait, as we're finishing up now mixing and putting everything in place.
I can't wait to hear it. We will talk much more with Israeli superstar David Broza when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Congregation Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming, and of course Hanukkah coming up soon. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us Friday night at 7315 North Oracle Road for Shabbat evening services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Join us this Shabbat, 7315 North Oracle Road, the west side of Oracle, north of Ina. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, enroll in our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and, of course, all of our services, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Or BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and the fastest-growing synagogue in all of Arizona at its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, just back from a trip, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Saying you're back from a trip just means you're here, frankly.
That's pretty much right. Yeah.
You had really some fascinating experiences in the Balkans. Maybe you'd share one about a city that we tend to associate Sarajevo with either a Haggadah or a horrible, terrible war.
Or a Winter Olympics.
Or the Winter Olympics. That's right.
So, yeah. Some of your listeners may remember that back in May, I led a trip to three cities in Morocco and three in Andalusia. And those three were Granada, Sevilla, and Cordoba. And those were the capitals and major cities of Sephardic Jewry for centuries. But then the Sephardim got expelled in 1492 from Spain and about 15 years later from Portugal. And many of them ended up in the Balkans, which were then under Ottoman rule. Some ended up also in Turkey. And so there are Ladino speakers all through the Balkan Peninsula and all through Western Turkey. One of the cities that has the most interesting history, I think, is Sarajevo, because, among other things, it was the place where the shot was fired that started World War One.
That's right.
Which many think was the same war as World War II with just a short intermission. So it was the site of one of the key events of 20th century history. It also is the place where the famous Sarajevo Haggadah is stored in the National Museum in a special vault that is temperature controlled and humidity controlled and access controlled up the wazoo and all kinds of UN organizations, the government of France, the European Commission, all kinds of things paid for this. I'm sure somehow that the National Museum of Bosnia and Herzegovina made a profit on this. Oddly, in spite of all this protection, it's only open 2 hours a week.
2 hours a week?
From 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
So when I get to Sarajevo, I know the
You have
rules.
To remember that. Holy so cow. By luck, we got to the museum about 10:30 a.m. on a Thursday. We learned this peculiarity of scheduling. And the museum has a ton of stuff to see. You could spend a day there if you were interested in art history or archaeology. It's several buildings around a courtyard with beautiful gardens and large stonework, monumental stuff. So it was no problem to kill time until the Haggadah Vault opened, and it was well worth seeing. But, you know, I at least go on these trips usually to teach people, but I always end up learning more than I teach. And one of the things I learned is that Sarajevo has its own Purim, called Sarajevo Purim.
Its own Purim.
Right. And at the beginning of November, it was exactly 200 years since the event that Purim commemorates. And the parallel is this. Megillat Esther, the Book of Esther that we read on Purim, recounts the tale of Queen Esther using her wiles to persuade the king to cancel the evil decree of the villain Haman and save the Jews of the kingdom. Well, in this case, the Sarajevo Muslims used their wiles with the Ottoman governor, who was an evil guy. He was their Haman, and he had planned to expel the Jews, and they got him to cancel the decree and save all the Jews of Sarajevo. So it's a close parallel, something nobody knows about in the West.
Me, including Rabbi Kohan.
I never even heard of it in Belgrade, but it's apparently a fact. I saw lots of articles about it, and there was a big celebration at least in the Balkans, of the Sarajevo Purim.
So another holiday to add to our calendar, at least when we're in Sarajevo.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We will talk more next week.
I look forward to it.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our expert on Israel, our Mivina Inbal Shtivi, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Inbal.
Boker. Oh, how are you?
I'm good. So if I were in Israel a couple weeks ago, and I wanted to go somewhere on Shabbat, I'd have a very hard time finding a bus, correct?
Extremely hard time finding a bus. Actually, not a bus, not a train. It's basically not available. It was not available for most parts of the country.
And not just Jerusalem, you know, Tel Aviv, Haifa, wherever you were. And now suddenly something's changed. And tell us about that.
Yeah. So in the past few years, there has been growing pressure from civil society organizations, researchers in the fields of, in areas of urbanism, and others as well, saying that part of what's going on is that we are too much dependent on private vehicles, on our cars. And as public transportation is not available on Shabbat, anyone, even those who never need a car, because they work in, let's say, Tel Aviv, and they live in, let's say, Tel Aviv, you don't need a car if you're living and working and spending your time in a big urban area. You just walk or use the public transportation. But if your parents live outside Tel Aviv, for example, and you want to visit with them during the weekend, you must own a car. And there have been many, many attempts on how to bypass this thing with different businesses coming into, you know, rentals and short-term rentals and only inside the Tel Aviv area rentals. There have been many, many different attempts to solve this, but actually only recently, and I'm not sure how exactly it happened because I was already here, ever since 2 weeks ago we have free transportation on Shabbat in Tel Aviv area, which means that it's not only Tel Aviv, It's the first collaboration between Tel Aviv Municipality, Givatayim Municipality, Ramat Gan Municipality. It's all satellite cities that are connected to Tel Aviv as part of the greater
urban area, the whole metropolis area, area of Tel Aviv.
Yeah. This is for me groundbreaking.
It's revolutionary in Israel. It's kind of amazing.
It is revolutionary. The whole situation is in many other areas of life, by the way, has to do with the structure of the Israeli democracy. We have a status quo with religious parties, with the religious population. Part of it was that would not be public transportation on weekends. There are many other parts of it, but it has to do with the meeting point or the interface between the state and the rabbinical institutions. It goes far and wide, way beyond this specific issue of public transportation on Shabbat. As you can imagine, it goes far and wide.
Kind of the whole secular religious divide in Israel. And I think most people don't really realize that perhaps 80% of the people in Israel are secular chilonim.
If you ask President Ruvi Rivlin, he sees that in 20, 30 years, we will have more Haredi, more religious population than
secular?
Secular, yeah.
Because of the huge birth rate. It's certainly possible, but it's certainly not true now. So this is a really interesting development, and maybe it's partly because of the political complications now. Inbal, thanks so much, and we will talk next week. And if you're in Israel, take a bus on Shabbat.
Oh, definitely. I cannot wait.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. It was a terrible night, cold, rainy, windy. The streets were deserted. The baker was about to close up shop when Bernie slipped through the door. He carried an umbrella blown inside out and was bundled up in sweaters and a thick coat. But he still looked wet and bedraggled. As Bernie unwound his scarf, he said to the baker, "May I have one bagel to go, please?" The baker said in astonishment, "One bagel? Nothing else on a night like this?" "That's right," answered Bernie, "one bagel for Bernice." "Bernice is your wife?" asked the baker. "Of course, my wife. What do you think?" snapped Bernie. "My mother would send me out on a night like this?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. The wonderful Festival of Lights and Latkes, Hanukkah, is coming up fast, beginning 2 weeks from tonight, running for 8 wonderful nights. Congregation Beit Simcha celebrates its first anniversary as a synagogue and the seventh night of the Festival of Religious Freedom with the elegant We Are One event, a night to remember. Join us for a fabulous evening of delicious Hanukkah food, champagne, and wine at a spectacular home overlooking all of Tucson Saturday, December 28th at 5 p.m. We'll celebrate Hanukkah with glowing candles, delicious latkes, songs, enjoy great entertainment, a silent auction, and much, much more. Details are on the Congregation Beit Simcha website, beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Don't miss this incredible evening of joy, entertainment, and friendship. We are one. We welcome our Shin Shinim, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, our young representatives of Israel from the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Shalom,
Boker Tov.
I'm wondering what Israelis think about Europe now, and I don't mean in some larger political sense, but, you know, Americans, Europe is some distant destination that you go on vacation and you plan for and so on. It's not really that way for Israelis, huh?
So for us, it's for, like, I mean, both of us, because we're young, so it's touch less than the old people because of the Israel is more expensive than a lot of countries. So they decide, oh, let's go to Germany, to Berlin. The Milky is much way cheaper in Israel. But I'm going to say it in justification wise. So like in Europe, it's so close. Okay, it's just like if you will take your car to Vegas
or drive to Colorado
or Utah or something. Right? Yeah, so you, it's better just to take a plane to Romania or something just to drink a coffee and come back to Israel.
Wow.
So yeah, it's such close.
So like I'll meet you tomorrow morning for coffee in Bucharest.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Right.
That's him. I stay for longer than coffee. I enjoy my staying in Europe.
No, I mean like...
No, so Europe for us, it's like spontaneous flights. It's something you can plan from like less than a week ahead. I know here everyone plans like their vacation like months ahead. In Israel, you could do
Let's go tomorrow.
Yeah, like they totally do that. It's totally inexpensive. Friends, there's a tradition for Israelis after you graduate high school, after like 12th grade, after 11th grade, you grab all of your friends. Yes.
That's like not classical.
But still, but you grab your friends and you just go to travel with your friends, only with your friends to Europe for a few days and that's it.
Yeah, it's not like the big trip after you're in the army.
No.
But just a quick trip to
like that.
To somewhere less expensive in Europe, for example. So, Shai, your family, you mentioned, vacationed regularly in the Schwarzwald, in the Black Forest in Germany.
Right.
So tell us that. You told us a story before.
All right. So since I was like 3 years old, so me and my family used to go to Schwarzwald, Black Forest, near to Freiburg in Germany. And every once in a while, we saw an old couple, Israeli couple, and was like, okay, hi, hey, they're the old people, they know the place, maybe, but we never seen, like, Israeli families there. And, like, 5 years ago, when we still go to there, and then we were shocked, we were amazed, like, all of the people, like, one from two, are Israeli.
Oh my God.
And was, like, really shocked, and it's also amazing that so quickly they discovered the place, but it's also sad because a lot of them are, I don't know, making bad impression and like, hey, Yochi, come over here, boy, Tirise Yofi, something like that. And
they're being, you know, Israelis. Right? Like they're at home.
Yeah.
Have many Israelis moved to Germany? Danielle, you can speak to this. You guys did that for a while, right?
Yeah, I lived in Germany for 3 years. And to be honest, when I lived there, which like was, I don't know, I was in third grade, so like about 10 years ago, I didn't see too many Israelis. Like for today, I know what Shai means. Like the Israelis hear about the popular places and they get there as fast as possible, but it's not everywhere. Like they stay there for like a while and then they go back. I mean, I live there and I barely hear any Israelis in Frankfurt, which is like the third largest city in Germany.
It's a big city. It's a fascinating city, by the way,
Frankfurt. And I barely heard any Israelis there.
Yeah.
So...
Well, I know there's a growing Israeli population in Germany.
For sure. In Berlin, there's a lot of
Berlin,
them.
Lots, because it's the cool city and there's a lot of business. And obviously, it's a financially successful country. And also, sometimes they do Israeli-German business. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of that. But, I never would have expected that. And for an American Jew to say, oh, people, Jews are moving to Germany from Israel, it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah. It is.
Thanks so much, guys. We'll talk next week.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And now a word of Torah. This week's Sedra Vayishlach in Genesis continues the tale of Jacob, most intriguing of all the patriarchs, a man who rises above his own duplicitous nature to become the father of almost all the tribes of Israel. As our story begins, Jacob is returning home to Canaan, having made good in the old country of Sumeria and Haran, today's Turkey, near the Syrian border. Jacob has 4 wives, 12 children, including 11 sons, and large flocks of sheep, herds of cattle, truly great wealth. As he's about to cross into Canaan, he learns that his brother Esau, whom he wronged so seriously just before leaving home in a rush 20 years before, is coming out to meet him with an army of 400 men. Jacob panics, deducing that Esau is not coming his way with an army with spears just to welcome him home. To try to preserve at least half of his household from his brother, Jacob divides his family and possession into two camps, carefully arranging a large gift for Esau. That night, he goes alone onto a small island in the midst of a tributary of the Jordan River, the Yavok, to contemplate his options. A stranger, who is called in Hebrew merely an ish, a guy, comes upon Jacob. The Torah is unclear as to whether this nocturnal visitor is a man, an angel, a representative of God, even a character in a dream. Jacob wrestles with the visitor the rest of the night. Finally, as dawn breaks, he prevails. The stranger cannot get away, and before he can escape, Jacob insists the stranger give him a blessing. It is at this moment that Jacob is given a new name, Yisrael, Israel, the first time that famous name is used in the Bible. It means one who wrestles with God. And we children of Israel, Jacob that is, have been wrestling with God in one way or another ever since. As the angel tells Jacob, your name shall be called Israel, for you have contended with gods and men and have prevailed. Jacob survives, and the reunion with Esau proves to be anticlimactic. Esau comes up to Jacob with all his armed men, but instead of attacking him, he gives his brother a big hug and a kiss. And if all is not forgiven, at least no blood is shed. The dramatic narrative of Jacob's struggle and triumph has become a metaphor for our own struggles with belief and family baggage. We are all descendants of Yisrael, the one who wrestled with God. And if we engage in that process for the sake of sacredness and belief, we too may triumph and reach our own promised land. Even during a season of merciless commercialism, holiness can still be created and found. In fact, it is that very search and struggle that make us the people Israel and give us a land engaged in that same pursuit. When we truly are children of the one who wrestled with God, when we choose to wrestle with God daily, we elevate our own lives and our experiences. May it be so for each of us this holiday season and in all seasons. Our guest this morning, the great Israeli singer, guitarist, songwriter, and peacemaker, David Broza, has been building musical bridges throughout his legendary career. Hear from him and about some of them when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
President Emmanuel Macron has pledged to fight anti-Semitism after 107 graves were desecrated at a Jewish cemetery in the northeast of France. The daubing of swastikas and other anti-Semitic graffiti on the graves at the cemetery of Westhofen, about 15 miles west of Strasbourg in the Alsace region, was the latest racist attack to shock the country. Jews are and make France, President Emmanuel Macron said. Those who attack them, even their graves, are not worthy of the idea we have of France. Anti-Semitism is a crime. We will fight it in Westhofen, as everywhere, until our dead can sleep in peace. In response to the latest in this string of attacks of anti-Semitic vandalism, France will open a national bureau to lead the fight against hate crimes. The office will be part of France's gendarmerie, and it'll be charged with investigating all anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim, and anti-Christian acts, said Interior Minister Christophe Castaner. The Republic itself has been desecrated, Castaner said after visiting the cemetery, which dates from the 16th century. The Alsace region has suffered a rash of racist vandalism over the past year, most notably the desecration of 96 tombs at a cemetery in Quatzenheim in February, which sparked nationwide outrage in France. The rising number of anti-Jewish offenses reported to police, up 74% in 2018 from the previous year, has caused alarm in a country that's home to both the biggest Jewish and the biggest Muslim communities in Europe. Earlier this year, French politicians from across the spectrum joined marches against anti-Semitism amid fears of its rise around the continent. They denounced a surge in attacks that some commentators blame on incitement by Islamist preachers, others on the rise of anti-Zionism, opposition to the very existence of Israel as a homeland for the Jewish people. The graves were desecrated just hours before the French Parliament adopted a resolution equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. French MPs approved a non-binding resolution modeled on the definition of anti-Semitism set by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. The definition, which serves as an international guideline, does not reference anti-Zionism, but does say denying Jews their right to self-determination is anti-Semitic. The World Jewish Congress hailed France's step for too long. Many have used the excuse that their obsessive criticism of Israel stands exclusive from their otherwise positive feelings for the Jewish people. Those days are now over, it said. Well, sadly, the days of anti-Semitism are not at all over. Not in France, not in Germany, not in England, not, well, nearly anywhere in Europe. Speaking of England, British actor Hugh Grant, who once famously played the Prime Minister of the UK in a movie, is the latest to come out and criticize the British Labour Party for not doing anything like nearly enough to root out the anti-Semitic element within the party. Grant supported the statement of British Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis last week. That statement took Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party to task for blatantly ignoring the deep anti-Semitism running within it. Hugh Grant said, "If you ask, do I think there's an anti-Semitic element within the Labour Party, the answer is yes. If you ask me, do I think the present Labour leadership has done anything like near enough to root it out, my answer is no." Grant was campaigning with Liberal Party parliamentary candidate Luciana Berger, who quit a safe Labour Party seat over Corbyn's refusal to renounce his own anti-Semitic positions and the offensive prevalence of anti-Jewish bias within the ranks of his party. And here in Arizona, the undergraduate student government of Arizona State University passed a resolution supporting the Tempe School's Jewish students. That resolution, which passed by acclamation, comes amid public discussion among ASU student organizations about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and in the wake of flyers bearing swastikas and Stars of David being circulated on campus. Last month, four pieces of legislation were submitted to the undergraduate student government at ASU Tempe on the topic of the conflict. One called for divestment from companies involved in human rights abuses, including a number in Israel. The resolutions were postponed over errors in the documents. The resolution to stand with Jewish students at ASU says the Jewish students have expressed concerns over their own safety on campus to the administration and to the police force in light of recent events, specifically Nazi propaganda. The ASU resolution says the student government supports all students in mutual civil dialogue and debate in an environment that is free from threat and intimidation and that it does not support anti-Semitism and stands by the Jewish community. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Israeli superstar musician David Broza, an incredible singer, songwriter, fantastic guitarist. We talked about his guitar work earlier, and a collaborator with so many remarkable musicians over the course of his career. This is a terrible question to ask. I'm asking it anyway. What was your favorite collaboration?
Well, that would be hard. You know, that would be really hard. I don't know, because you always, whenever I'm in a situation, I know it's the best situation I've ever had. I've never walked into a collaboration or a situation where I thought, what a mistake, this is not as good as I thought, or this is not going to bring anything. I've been very lucky. Most of my collaborations have been actually with poets and writers throughout my career, as I've chosen to indulge in writing the melodies and not the lyrics, although I have written lyrics and I have actually a whole album dedicated to my lyrics and the music. But most of my collaborations have been with poets, and those have been amazing, because through collaboration I get to meet outstanding, even talking about Arizona, as I'm coming to play in Tucson,
right,
at the Fox Theater, one of my probably most successful collaborations was actually with poet laureate, the only poet of Arizona, Alberto Rios, who's out living, he's actually from Nogales, and originally, and we collaborated through me reading his books, actually, and writing music to some of his poems, and as this, I'm talking about something that happened 35 years ago, but the result of which we got to meet each other and work alongside and together and collaborate on pieces which were not just the poetry. And so that what I call a successful collaboration in every way is when you walk out of a collaborating and the person you collaborated with becomes actually a soulmate, a real friend. And I think this is what happened with me and Alberto and with many other poets and every musician that I've happened to work with over the years.
Did you ever think you'd share a stage with people or share a bill with people like Bob Dylan or Paul Simon or some of the people that inspired you?
Well, you know, I didn't have aspirations to be a musician. And then once I was,
that's right.
And things were thrown at me and brought to me. Of course, if I was to be asked, what would be your wishful list, you know? And I would say, yeah, Bob Dylan, Paul Simon, Van Morrison, you know, things like that. And then I have my good musicians who I've played with many times as jazz groups like Al Di Meola or Spyro Gyra and then Paco de Lucia and a lot of, like, as we go on, you know, and through life, I keep on saying, wow, this should be amazing to play with these people and or share the bill. And I've been very lucky.
You have been an advocate for peace, for mutual understanding. Maybe it feels as far now as it ever has from realization. But how does music change that? Can it help change that?
Of course, music is a very big part. It has a big role to play in social change and political change and perception of life. I think it's the most effective and primal tool that we have to bring people together. It's, you know, when I'm a grassroots kind of guy. I'm not impressed by politics. I'm not impressed by politicians. I'm aware of them. I watch out and read, and I'm very, very, very aware of what's happening around the world in every given moment. And I'm a history freak, so I read a lot of history books and philosophy. But I'm a real grassroots guy. So I'd rather work with underprivileged, with kids with special needs, and with people who are in conflict, whether it's emotional or in the Israeli-Palestinian cause. It's a political and a religious one, and one of ownership, because we all fight for the same land. And the most important thing is bridging the gaps. And the biggest gap in the Israeli-Palestinian relations on a day-to-day life, from the grassroots point of view, from the people's point of view, is the distance, the emotional distance we have from each other. We distrust. We're afraid of each other. We look at each other as sheer and mere enemies, when actually it's a misconception. You know, that's everybody's frightened. Both sides are frightened, and they act so. Some are more capable of controlling their and building their world, like Israel has done the miraculous, unlike anything else in the world, to create a country from scratch, from nothing, to create a society, to create an identity that was never there 100 years ago, now is, and is respected and is regarded and is even feared at times, but mostly people look up to it, is unreal. It's I don't think in the history of mankind there has been something like that. You could say the United States, but different conditions, different situation. And this is a small country, small people in comparison to the billions that are around the world. And so you have to come to terms with the fact that there's other people also. There's Christians, there's Muslims, there's Druze, there's Cherkess, basically the Arab population, which comprises of 20% of the Israeli population, of the Jewish population in Israel. And then you have surrounding Palestinian in the West Bank and in Gaza. These are all people that you have to learn how to deal with, but how would you do it if there's no personal relationship, if there's no understanding of who these people are, that they're also mothers and fathers like we are, and that they don't really want to kill you. They need to have some kind of a compromise along the way, which would make sense to everybody. And then the compromise would only come if we know each other, if we sing together, if we eat the kebab together, a barbecue, or we have a coffee together. And that sort of thing that is not going to happen in 70 years, not going to happen in 100 years. It could take a lot longer. But the beautiful thing is that every day there's more educators and there are more people from all walks of life in Israel and on the Palestinian side who are actually searching for the connection, for the contact. And so there's a lot of programs. And in some of those programs, and I think the most successful ones, it's where there's music and art involved, that there is the big, you make actually the biggest moves, and you can tell that there is a change coming through because people start looking at each other as people. After you look at each other as people, you can start putting the problems on the table. And these problems are tough problems, and they can lead to horrible confrontations, but the people are talking. And so my belief is that in the next generation or the next two or three generations, it's probably the next generation or within our time too, there will be a compromise and there will be a solution to this conflict. There's got to be. The Irish have found a solution, you know, after 330 years of fighting. I mean, there's so many stories of solutions in the world. And they were also, and they're more similar to each other than the Israelis and the Palestinians or the Jews and the Arabs. And they had a huge conflict.
Forever. And just as brutal, really.
True. And it could fall apart any minute. But with sensible and sensitive leadership amongst the people, then their religious leaders, the political leaders, it all goes up and up and up, all the way from down to the top. It doesn't go from the top down. I don't think a leadership can dictate peace in the Middle East. It has to be adjacent. It has to be at the same, in parallel to what's happening in the grassroots, in the field, in the actual, amongst the people. There has to be. There's got to be a program. There's got to be reconditioning. There's got to be education, re-educating. And more people are regarding that as an essential part of the process that we're going. And these people are right-wing, left-wing, settlers, non-settlers. Everybody's into this.
Religious, secular.
Everybody.
You know, David, in this next round of Israeli elections, can I vote for you for prime minister?
if you promise me to remain in the grassroots and then we can just walk the streets together and hug and shake hands and sing songs with people, if that's my role, yeah, for sure.
I want to thank David Broza for a fabulous visit here on Two Jewish. Go see him at the Fox Theater December 21st. There's more information about that elsewhere in the show. David, thank you so much. It's a great honor.
Yeah, hope to see you at the show. You know, with all my Cuban and Spanish musicians, it's going to be a blast.
It's going to be really fun.
For Tucson.
Yeah, I can't wait. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical playout from David Broza.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish when our guest will be Debbie Sensiper, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Citizen 865, The Hunt for Hitler's Soldiers in America. Our playout this morning comes from our incredible guest this week, David Broza. You can see him at the Fox Theater Saturday night, December 21st in concert, and you can get tickets at the Weintraub Israel Center Facebook page or by emailing israelcenter@jfsa.org or going to the Fox Theater website or box office. He's fabulous. This is his wonderful hit song, Sigaliot, Violets. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
היא התחתנה והיא מאושרת למרות שבעלה היה מין שד ופרד כל הזמן מצוברח קבוע והוא אפילו לא אומר מדוע שלוש שנים שהיא מקבלת
מגבר זר מתחת דלת מכתבי שירה אליה הם מאירים את אלוניה
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.